Hi, I'm Riley Fessler. I'm a podcast producer here at the DSR Network, which means that my job is to make sure that we have great content and great guests across all of our shows. Our programming is supported by our members, and for that, we are truly grateful. I hope that you'll consider becoming a member to support the work that we do. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack and Discord communities. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support. Today's episode from the archive comes from March of last year, when Alon Pincus joined David Rothkopf for a conversation on the political crisis that faced the Netanyahu government. We hope you enjoy.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super-secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello, and welcome to a special edition of the podcast. I'm your host, David Rothkopf, coming to you from Washington, D.C. We're joined today by our friend, former senior Israeli diplomat and government advisor, Alon Pincus, who is in Israel. And the reason we are holding this special podcast is, of course, that over the weekend, there were massive demonstrations in Israel, perhaps as many as 600,000 people, focused on a series of events that could only really be described as a constitutional crisis at this point, that included the resignation or firing of the defense minister associated with his resistance to the Netanyahu judicial reforms, and have continued through to today with not just demonstrations, strikes, shutting down of the airport, but also apparently a decision by Netanyahu and his right-wing coalition to postpone the judicial reforms until allegedly the summer, which does not mean democracy has been saved in Israel, although it seems to have been given a reprieve. And so the place I begin, since the situation is so fluid, is with Alon, and a question about whether I've summarized that well and what I've gotten wrong.
No, you've summarized it perfectly, David. Thank you for being on your podcast again. Look, the demonstrations in the last week were unprecedented. The demonstration last night, that would be Sunday night in Israel, were something extraordinary and truly fascinating, in that it took less than an hour from the news of Netanyahu dismissing the defense minister, who's not particularly popular amongst the demonstrators by any measure, but nonetheless, the context of his dismissal drove 250,000 Israelis into the streets within an hour. And there was this sense of elation that I would call, and I don't tend to usually be dramatic or grandstanding, there was a sense that this was a second Independence Day. Now, whether or not Netanyahu's decision today to suspend, he did not cancel the legislation, he just suspended it until July, as part of an agreement that he reached with his extreme nationalistic right-wing partners, in exchange for which he will authorize them to operate no less than a militia, an armed militia, subordinate to them, to a coalition party, which is a Balkanization or Lebanonization of Israel. And so in that respect, David, saying that democracy won a reprieve remains to be seen. And the question is, will the demonstrations persist? Will anyone take Netanyahu's word for it, for the suspension or the postponement? Disclaimer, probably not. And you know, let's see how the dynamic plays out in the next few weeks. There's going to be some kind of a crescendo between now and July. This is not going to just roll, you know, until July without anything happening.
Lot to unpack there. I should say to the audience that we are speaking in the middle of the day on Monday. This is relatively fluid. Prime Minister Netanyahu has indicated that he is going to make remarks. He was supposed to do that several hours ago. Not sure exactly when today he will make the remarks, but the substance of those remarks seems to have been foreshadowed by this statement by one of the right-wing parties that Netanyahu has agreed to freeze it. Let's explore that for a brief second, because I think it's relevant. You indicated that they have been given the right to form a militia or a National Guard. This is the has been the wish of the National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is himself a convicted supporter of terrorists, right-wing terrorists.
Only 3 times.
Only 3 times, exactly. So he is one of the most extreme of the extremists. The thought of him having his own National Guard strikes me as absolutely crazy. Does it strike you as absolutely crazy?
Of course it is. It's you know, it's not what you think when you talk about a well-regulated militia. This is a Second Amendment without constitutional overview. This is essentially a militia that will be made of extremist settlers that will operate either in the territories in the West Bank against Palestinians or inside Israel as an extra police force, as an extra curricular police forces, an extra judicial police force, emphasize the extra. This is no less, David, than Netanyahu being a complete nihilist that he is, and recklessly outsourcing the state's sovereignty, you know, the monopoly over the legitimate use of violence, quoting Max Weber. He's doing everything to buy some political time because he's in a serious political predicament.
Go on.
No, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to say he's in a serious political predicament and a serious legal predicament. Well, yeah. And that is something that echoes with what's going on here in the United States. Because one of the reasons Netanyahu has a bee in his bonnet or a burr under his saddle about the judiciary is that the judiciary is coming after him. The longer it goes unattended to, the greater the peril for him, right?
Absolutely. Look, if you're looking for similarities between Netanyahu and Trump, you do not need to look too far. It's right there in front of you. The rhetoric, the MO, the victimization, the jargon, the lexicon, indeed, the entire political state of mind is identical. There's this deep state out to get me. There is the deep state consists of the security organs and the law enforcement agencies and the Justice Department / the Ministry of Defense, of the Ministry of Justice in Israel. The media is after me. It is funded from by external sources. By the way, both sides cite George Soros as one of the funders of the of a campaign, of a cabal and campaign against them. So the similarities are uncanny. the only difference is that Trump was indicted after, or is being indicted after he was president, while Netanyahu is prime minister throughout and during his trial on three separate indictments of corruption, breach of trust, and bribery, alleged bribery. So the way these two democracies, Israel and the U.S., with all due differences between them, the way the two are combating these anti-democratic forces is also somewhat similar. Look, you spoke about the demonstrations, just to give listeners a sense, David. Until now, roughly 20% of Israelis participated in demonstrations. 20% is equivalent to roughly 63 million Americans, 64 million Americans. Imagine that in 2.5 months, 64 million Americans would have participated in demonstrations. This is astounding, and not to mention the fact that it applies to 80% of the population, because the Arab population, the Palestinian population inside Israel, which consists of 20% of the general population, has stayed out, by and large, stayed out of the demonstration. So the number is huge. Netanyahu realizes that, and this war that he's waging against, in fact, the entire country, but the specifically against the judiciary, is very much like the war that you see Trump or the Trumpists and the MAGA movement, if you can call it that, conducting in the U.S.
Did you go and look at the demonstrations, participate?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
What was it like? What was the mood like?
Well, I wasn't there. I was there last night in a smaller demonstration, because, believe it or not, on the way to the bigger demonstration, the road was blocked by a smaller demonstration. So I had no choice but to get out of the car and join the smaller demonstration, which also was 5,000 people, but almost nearly 5,000. What you see is a rejuvenation of the concept of Israeliness. You know, the Israel that many of us thought is gone and no longer exists, and, you know, the communal bonds that tie us, and the Israeli ethos that many have decried that has been lost. You see that in the demonstration. Another element that you see, and I've been to several demonstrations. I actually been in several places. You have speakers, so I've spoken to, and I could get a better sense of the crowd. Another two, three characteristics is one, the endurance of the demonstration. This has been going on for 13 weeks running. Everyone thought, you know, it'll run out of steam, that it will weaken, that people will say, yeah, I've been last week, no point in going this week, too crowded, too dangerous, raining, what have you. No, in fact, they grow week after week. It started with 40,000, and it reached, just in Tel Aviv, and it reached over 320,000 last Saturday, two nights ago. The second characteristic is the age group. If you look at the demographics and the age cohorts, you see that these demonstrations are not your typical center left liberal, primarily yes, but they are not exclusively your center left liberal crowds. You have religious, and you have older people, and you have a younger generation. In fact, one of the slogans of the demonstration in the last 2 or 3 weeks has been, Mr. Netanyahu, you're messing around with the wrong generation. Meaning, okay, we understand what you did here in the last decade, it stops here. And the last characteristic is the wide scale use, and you saw that in pictures, I'm sure many of the listeners, those listeners who've been watching, the use of flags. You wouldn't think much of it, but the flag was sort of expropriated by the right wing, you know, as a sign of, I wave the flag, ergo, I'm a patriot, you don't wave the flag, you're a cosmopolitan, I don't care much, you know, latte drinking, wine sipping, you could live in Berlin or in Washington, D.C. just as easily. No. What you see here is a combination of the top echelons of the Israel Defense Forces, and the top echelons of the economy, and the high-tech sector, and the academic world, And today, the Histadrut, the trade union federation, which is the equivalent of the AFL-CIO in the U.S., they joined. And today was they called for a general strike, which was kept almost hermetically throughout the day. So in these demonstrations, you see a spirit that you thought dissipated during the years. And, you know, if during the last few election cycles, you could say, all right, you know, the gluten that holds the center left is this hatred and aversion toward Mr. Netanyahu. It's still there. But now they're fighting for something else. Now it's all about democracy. And Netanyahu is just seen as another part of the problem. This is about an assault on a general, comprehensive, deep, fundamental assault on democracy. And the demonstrations not only reflect that, but it seems at least that they believe in what they're doing.
So Netanyahu thinks, well, I don't know what he thinks, but apparently he's postponing proceeding with the judicial reforms. But, you know, as we've said, it comes at a high price, this militia or National Guard. But the announcement that came from Ben Gavir's group said postponing until after the spring recess.
Right.
You know, other reports I've seen said till the summer. I don't know what Netanyahu is going to see. But what does he buy with that? I mean, are the demonstrators just going to go away and then come back in 2 months? Is there going to be pressure following the deal with Ben Gavir? Are there other issues? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, okay, here's the thing. What he thinks he's buying is time. He thinks that buying this time would diminish the intensity of the demonstrations, will take the sting out of the entire protest movement. And he did it for a reason. There were two possibilities he stood in front of right now, and I'm not sure they're going to change, but here they are. He may not have had the majority, you know, with the statement, the proclamation that the defense minister made yesterday, that he intends to vote against these amendments to the basic laws curtailing the judiciary and turning Israel effectively into a semi-authoritarian autocracy. He may not have had the majority, but worse than that, we all talk about a constitutional crisis, David. Fact is, we're being engulfed by an almost constitutional crisis. The real constitutional crisis would have occurred a week or 2 weeks from now, when these laws would have passed a third reading in parliament, in the Knesset, for the benefit of the listeners. I'll explain, the how a bill becomes a law from sixth grade. Okay, Israeli version. A law has to pass a preliminary reading and then three readings in between each, the Knesset committee or the congressional committee for comparison, makes amendments and changes, takes out issues, clauses, adds clauses. Once it passes, a third reading, it is ready to be presented to the Knesset for as a law. That's when the Supreme Court entertains petitions and appeals. The Supreme Court, with a very, very high likelihood, David, would have struck down most of these laws. That would have presented Netanyahu with a real constitutional crisis. Do you abide by the Supreme Court decision, i.e. the rule of law, or do you defy the Supreme Court and thus throwing in Israel into complete constitutional chaos? He thinks that by postponing this until July, enough time will pass for some kind of understanding, the level of the opposition and the intensity of the demonstrations will be subdued. And then by July, he will pass not all of it as one package, but two or three laws, then another one, and then another one. Thing is, this man has a major, Netanyahu, has a major credibility deficit. No one on either the left, the right, or for that matter, the center, believes him. His track record on making political promises and pledges and statements is that he is almost, his default position is to manipulate and probably lie. And so I don't think this will hold until July. And I don't think the demonstrations will be subdued.
The U.S. relationship with Israel is a special relationship. And we've seen that in good ways and bad over the years. Recently, I personally have found the commentary, and I'm very supportive of the Biden administration generally, but I personally found their commentary regarding this to be, at least publicly, muted. Even this weekend with 600,000 people in the streets, they were talking about compromise. It doesn't seem to me to be terribly healthy to compromise around fundamental issues of democracy like judicial independence. And that, in fact, every compromise with a fundamental issue of democracy ends up being a dilution or diminution of the democracy. And that, of course, is dangerous. Another thing that I found troubling about all of this, you were the person who brought it to my attention, is that apparently Netanyahu has been invited to the summit of democracies, even though, you know, he seems hell-bent on diminishing the democracy. And by the way, this isn't his first swing at it, right? The last time he was prime minister, they had, a citizenship law, you know, that and other things that also reduced democratic protections in Israel. What do you think about the response of the Biden administration?
Well, okay, so I'll tell you two things that may seem somewhat contradictory. On the one hand, I think it would be wrong for Israelis to expect the Biden administration to bail them out, to save Israel from itself. I mean, this appeal to the U.S., help us, save us, is somewhat ridiculous. And to assume that the U.S. is inclined or willing or is actually interested in making a major intervention in another country's domestic politics seems to be far-fetched. On the other hand, the American administration was, you know, bland vanilla. Sugarless tofu vanilla. I don't fault them for being amazed, because if you look at the trajectory of the U.S. response, you do see an intensification. You do see a dynamic of escalation. You know, it started, David, before the government was formed. After the election, before the government was formed, then it wasn't an administration. It was Senator Bob Menendez, who was then and still is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who warned Netanyahu publicly not to form a coalition with these characters, with the extreme right wing. Then came anonymous American concerns from the National Security Council, the State Department, and around the White House, all those euphemisms, that the U.S. is unhappy, and gravely concerned if Netanyahu authorizes or bestows on these two gentlemen, Ben Gvir and another guy, Bezalel Smotrich, any sensitive portfolio. Well, he did just that. Then Secretary of State Antony Blinken came here for no apparent reason pertaining to his role as Secretary of State, and essentially stood next to Netanyahu in a press conference and admonished and criticized and educated him on the basic tenets of democracy. And lauded civil society, i.e. the demonstrations. Then came a Biden exchange of emails with Tom Friedman in the New York Times. Then came another statement from Blinken. Then came a 45-minute phone conversation between Netanyahu and Biden. All throughout, David, the U.S. administration, the Biden administration, did not invite Netanyahu to Washington. That's a big deal, because a trip to Washington and a visit to the White House and a photo op at the Oval is a coronation of sorts for any American, for any Israeli incoming prime minister. And Netanyahu is no different, even though he's done it three or four times before. And he, in fact, is the first of the last 13 Israeli prime ministers, himself included, that within 90 days of being inaugurated has neither visited nor been invited to the White House. And that says something about how the U.S. feels about him. At the same time, just, you know, one last observation about this. At the same time, the U.S. keeps on using this really sanctimonious language, compromise that you mentioned, dialogue, consensus, consent. It's as if they either are ignoring or totally misunderstand the scope, the scale, and the seriousness of this crisis. This is a crisis that is threatening the very foundation of the U.S.-Israeli relationship, which since the fall, the disintegration of the Soviet Union, is based on shared values, not on arms deals and not on containing communism, on shared values. And Israel is actively retreating from those shared values. And the U.S. is calling for consent and compromise and let's meet halfway. Sounds sort of, you know, weird.
Democracy summit?
Yeah. you know, first I saw that the Biden administration has disinvited or neglected or deliberately neglected to invite Turkey and Hungary because those countries do not qualify as democracies. Then I saw that Mr. Netanyahu was not only invited, but that he's also scheduled to speak on the interplay of democracy and economics. Okay, even on the assumption that the invitation was extended before this judicial recalibration or regime changing campaign has been launched, there's still time to disinvite. And by the way, they may still disinvite him or say, or at least cancel his speaking rights. That would be a major step for the administration. I'm not encouraging them to do so. I don't know what the parameters and principles that guide them when granting someone the speaking opportunity, but that he, under these circumstances, is speaking about democracy. Come on, this is like Al Capone talking about the importance of law enforcement at Wrigley Field. This is ridiculous.
Absolutely, absolutely ridiculous. And an opportunity for the Biden administration to send a strong message. The flip side is if he goes to this thing and then goes back to Israel afterwards and guts the judiciary, it makes the...
I think it's Zoom. I think it's remote. I'm not sure he's going to travel to Washington. Otherwise,
excuse me, you're absolutely right. But in any event, following this, you know, he speaks or participates and then goes and strikes a blow against democracy. I don't think it enhances the credibility of the event. And by the way, there's also the Mexican president who's also doing his work against democracy is participating. So it's not just Netanyahu. Let me ask you one last question. You know, a lot of the debate around Israel has been colored recently by an effort by Netanyahu and the far right to suggest that any criticism of the Israeli government amounts to veiled anti-Semitism. This has to do with, everything from the BDS movement to speaking out on behalf of the Palestinians. Etc. And a number of U.S., you know, Jewish organizations have sort of picked up on this theme. Personally, I think it's very important for there to be a distinction in every country, not just Israel, between the government and the people and the identity of the country. And so, you know, one can be critical of an administration or a leader and still have good feelings and relations with the people of that country. I was just wondering how you know, the all this colors that in your eyes, because it seems to me the Netanyahu and the far right are abusing the support that they've had for a long, long time.
Yes, to be fair, you can make the argument, David, that Israel has been abusing it even before Netanyahu. But to be fair to Israel, look, what Netanyahu is doing is classical textbook 101, whatever cliche we want to use here, populist demagogic manipulation. He's taking something that has a grain of truth in it, and then extrapolating it and blowing it completely out of proportion. There's a grain of truth in that some anti-Israeli criticism over the years was tainted or polluted by anti-Semitism. However, you can criticize Israel without being an anti-Semite. In fact, Mr. Netanyahu enjoys the support of a lot of Americans who would qualify as being in a unique category of anti-Semites who love Israel. And he has a lot of those friends in the MAGA movement, and he had them in the Tea Party movement that preceded MAGA. But I think he's absolutely taken advantage of it, but he's done something even worse in terms of American support, David. And I think I wrote about it, as have you in some instances. Netanyahu deliberately departed from the principle of Israel as a bipartisan issue. Now, bipartisanship on Israel, from an Israeli point of view, not from an American congressional point of view, is that you would do everything you possibly can, religiously, actively, not to make Israel a wedge issue. For years, since the 70s at least, for decades, it worked. The sources of support for Israel on the Democratic side and on the Republican side come from different origins. They are different in style, characteristic, and content, but nonetheless, Israel was not a wedge issue. He first began turning it into a wedge issue around the time that the GOP began to change its face, meaning in the mid-90s when Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House, and there was this anti Bill Clinton thing about the Republican Party that pulled it way to the right, as an antecedent to the Tea Parties, as a preamble to MAGA. But then when Obama became president, Netanyahu went full replacement theory. He's replacing American Jews with evangelical Christians. He's replacing bipartisanship with a alignment with the GOP. He has basically severed ties with the Democrats. He plays the game. If a Democratic senator, a member of the House, a governor, or indeed an administration member comes to Jerusalem, he will meet him and pretend that, you know, that there's always been a keen friendship and love between them. But you see it in his how he never got along with Clinton, how he detested Obama, the bromance that he had with Trump. And this is how, and why am I saying all this? Because this has become an instrument for him to use inside Washington to abuse that support and diplomatic cover that for years he's been getting from the US. So much so that in some red states, some Republican controlled states, you have anti-BDS laws. Which, you know, BDS is a horrible thing, but he turned the BDS from a cockroach into a dinosaur, into a huge murderous beast. The BDS was never like that, and he's the one who's trying to blur the distinction between criticizing Israel and being an anti-Semite, except for one thing, David. He's adding himself into the equation. Meaning, if you dislike Netanyahu, if you criticize Netanyahu, ergo, you're discrediting Israel, which makes you, by extension, an anti-Semite. This is a modern incarnation of Louis XIV. He is the state, and he's responsible for world Jewry. Which is why some of the reaction, not all, but most of the reaction, some and most of the reaction amongst American Jews has been encouraging. And we'll have to wait and see how this internal crisis in Israel affects relations with American Jewry and the American political system. There have been encouraging signs, two letters that have been signed, one by 92 members of the House, all Democrats, and one by 16 Jewish lawmakers. That's been encouraging. But to go back to your point, yes, he's been abusing that support and manipulating it constantly. And what really astonishes me, is how administration after administration, people in D.C., within the U.S. government, continue to willingly buy this manipulation and subject themselves to it. Yes, they're mitigating circumstances, never turn Israel into an issue. We're entering an election year. Why would I alienate the pro-Israel community? Okay, these are mitigating circumstances. And in a defining crisis as we are facing now, I just don't see any justification for anyone to maintain their, lax attitude when they see what Netanyahu is doing.
Yeah, totally agree with you. And just as I might add a final word of my own, I think that this is a very important moment for people in the U.S. to step up like the people of Israel have, if having a democracy in the Middle East matters. And by the way, I set aside the issue of the democratic, I acknowledge the issue that Palestinians living within Israel's border have not had certain fundamental democratic rights. And I strongly believe that that is an issue that must be addressed. But the further erosion of democratic rights in Israel is an issue that strongly requires people in the United States to stand up and say, this is not the same as the past. Netanyahu's crossing lines. The risks are great. It's not just judicial reform. We've seen other things in the past. This prospect of this militia, as you call it, is deeply disturbing. And so it's time for people, and I personally believe it's time for the administration to say, look, you do this, all bets are off. No blank check, no visits, the kind of support you've had in the past will be paused. We move on and the country turns the page from this chapter and presumably seeks to restore both democracy and relations, then we can move on from it. But tiptoeing around this issue is only likely to make it worse. I also think the American people have a lot to learn from the courage and energy of the Israelis going out and using their right to peaceful assembly and free speech to say, no, we're not going any further. And frankly, given some of the things we've seen in the U.S. with Trump, who's likely to be in a very similar position, and who is running for president for the same reason, to protect himself from the law, I think we need to pay close attention to all of this. So I'm so glad you were able to spend some time with us. I suspect, for all the reasons we said here, that we're going to continue this conversation in the weeks and months ahead, and I look forward to it. So thank you, Alon. Thank you to everybody for listening, and we'll be back again soon. Bye-bye.